Another Montana school closes after a fake bomb threat. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a new wrinkle in the debate over the contentious Flathead Water Compact. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry takes us to the construction site of a Habitat for Humanity home. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the director of the University of Montana's Disability Services for Students about a new agreement that will make sure disabled students can access campus technology. The Frenchtown Middle and High School were evacuated this morning after a bomb threat, and school was closed while sheriff's deputies and a bomb-sniffing dog searched the school. The search turned up nothing, and school will reopen tomorrow. Sheriff's Department spokeswoman Paige Pavlone says the bomb threat was scrawled on a boys' bathroom mirror in the junior high.
And it was scribbled with a green highlighter on the glass, so you can barely read it, but it said that there will be a bomb in the school, and it didn't say today, as we had originally heard, but it just said that there will be a bomb in the school.
Pavlone says officials continue to investigate the incident. It follows a phoned-in bomb threat yesterday that temporarily closed Helena Elementary schools.
And in other news from around the state, a University of Montana student was injured by a chainsaw this morning during construction for this weekend's Foresters Ball in the Adams Center West Auxiliary Gym. University spokeswoman Peggy Kaur says the accident happened about 8 o'clock this morning.
They build a frontier town, so to speak, and one student was handling a chainsaw and another student who was helping with the log they were working on was injured when the chainsaw kicked back and hit the other student in the leg.
Kaur says two other students who are EMTs offered aid till the ambulance arrived. Kaur says the injured student required 40 stitches in his leg but will be released from the hospital this evening. The Foresters Ball will go on as scheduled this weekend.
University of Montana alumni Tom Cotter has committed $11 million of his estate to be used for academic scholarships at his alma mater. It's the single largest pledge for scholarships in the UM's history. Cotter grew up on a ranch near Townsend without running water, plumbing, or electricity. He was accepted into the Merchant Marines during World War II and at the age of 16. After the war, he worked as a deckhand on a freighter, then earned his master's degree from the University of Montana. Cotter then served as a special agent in the Army Counterintelligence Corps for 2 years, worked for Boeing for 9, then tried his hand and enjoyed tremendous success at a financial planning career. UM President Royce Engstrom described Cotter's gift as transformative.
That gift will generate nearly $500,000 a year for scholarships. And Mr. Cotter attached very few restrictions to those scholarships. He's interested in providing scholarship for Montana students and students who have financial need. So that does two very important things. One is it will provide opportunities for students who might otherwise not be able to attend college at all because of their financial limitations. And that is tremendous in the sense of opening doors for those young people so that they can go on to have the kind of enjoyable, productive careers and lives that Mr. Cotter himself had.
Cotter's gift will also provide a pool of funds that Engstrom says will enable UM to be more competitive in its recruitment efforts.
Everyone at the university is working very hard to enhance our recruiting efforts and our student success retention efforts and so on. The University of Montana is an absolutely great place to get an education, and we want as many students as possible to have the benefit of a UM education.
Engstrom adds the $11 million gift is a real boon to UM's scholarship base.
Mr. Cotter's gift is certainly a lead gift for our investing in student success effort that we have going on as a partnership between the university and the University of Montana Foundation. So we're working extremely hard over the approximately a three-year period to increase our scholarship base in a dramatic way and improve some of our programmatic aspects of the university that focus on student success. So Tom's gift just gets us started on that effort in a remarkable way.
The 84-year-old Cotter lives with his wife in Palo Alto, California, and still enjoys alpine skiing and volunteer work.
Montana continues looking for ways to keep the sage grouse off the endangered species list. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering listing the chicken-sized prairie bird across 11 western states. Last year, Governor Steve Bullock formed an advisory board to draft a plan for managing sage grouse. The board submitted that plan to the governor at the end of January. Efforts to keep the bird off the endangered list could impact the state's agriculture, telecommunications, mining, and oil industries. Advisory board member and Cascade Democratic Senator Bradley Hamlet says it would be far worse if the sage grouse was listed.
If you think the listing of the wolf as an endangered species had an impact on Montana, it would be nothing compared to what this will be. This impacts so much more land and so much what you can do on that land.
The Bullock administration says the governor will likely issue an executive order to implement parts of the plan next month. This could include changing what activities would be allowed near grouse mating areas. Montana is also one of several states that still hunts the sage grouse despite the threat of listing. The Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks says hunters harvest about 3,000 to 4,000 birds annually during the two-month hunting season. Scobie Republican Senator John Brendan says perhaps that hunt should be reconsidered in an effort to boost populations.
If that not hunting season for a while would make a difference with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, I think it's something that the governor should look at.
FWP does not currently have a reliable estimate of Montana's sage grouse population.
More are calling for a reopening of negotiations on the Flathead Water Compact. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes have been working on this agreement with the state and federal governments and private irrigators for at least a dozen years. It would settle disputes over how water is shared on the Flathead Reservation. The State Commission, which helped craft the compact, now says renegotiations may be warranted. But Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the tribes are holding firm with the current version.
The 2013 legislature did not pass the Flathead Water Compact. It was the first time that had happened. Agreements reached by Montana's Reserved Water Rights Compact Commission on the state's other six reservations passed their first time through. But the Flathead Compact is the most complex and has proven to be the most controversial.
I'm a citizen here, and I just want to be treated like a citizen. I shouldn't have to come here and fight for that.
John Swenson has a small ranch near Ronan. He irrigates on fee land inside the Flathead Indian Reservation. He's one of a large group of irrigators who feel they will lose water through the deal.
I'm not willing to give my water right up to anybody.
The water compact process was developed in the 1970s as a way to prevent decades of legal battles among the tribes, the government, and the irrigators. The tribes have the oldest water rights, dating back to before Montana was even a state. They argue they could go to court and secure all of the water rights on the reservation. The compact is supposed to be a compromise with the government and with irrigators like John Swenson. And the tribes say irrigators will not lose water through the agreement, but Swenson disagrees. He looks at the water use models put forth by the tribes. He looks at the water he needs. And to him, it doesn't add up.
Doesn't add up with transpiration, doesn't add up with anything that I've been able to physically observe.
Swenson was talking to the legislature's Water Policy Interim Committee, which is looking at the compact to try to decide whether to recommend passage during the next legislature. Libby Republican Senator Chaz Vincent chairs the committee. He's asking the tribes for information on how they arrived at the figures in their models, the figures which say irrigators won't lose water through the compact.
The problem is for policymakers, and for the state for that matter, there's no way really for us to validate that claim one way or the other.
Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes attorney Rhonda Swaney says the tribes allowed state employees to look at the modeling for years, and it was only accessed once. They have not agreed to do so since.
It's proprietary. We paid millions of dollars for it and didn't feel like that was something we needed to do.
Most of the private irrigators on the reservation signed onto the compact as one group, the Flathead Joint Board of Control. Problem is, that group has since dissolved into three different entities. The language of the compact only refers to the Joint Board of Control for those irrigators. So, chair of the Reserved Water Rights Compact Commission, Chris Tweeton, says that should be corrected. He says the commission is strongly considering recommending to Governor Steve Bullock negotiations be reopened.
To try to bring into the compact proper some of the provisions in the water use agreement that would provide protections for the irrigators' existing uses of water on the reservation.
Ultimately, the decision on whether to ask the tribes back to the negotiating table falls on Governor Bullock. The tribes have said repeatedly the only two options on the table are the 2015 legislature approves the compact as is, or the issue heads to litigation. And the tribes have already filed a narrow lawsuit in federal court, seeking to determine the owner of the water used by the irrigators. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
The historical role of women in the U.S. Indian Service is the focus of a talk tonight on the University of Montana campus as part of Women's History Month. University of New Mexico historian Kathleen Cahill is the author of the book Federal Fathers and Mothers, A Social History of the United States Indian Service, 1869 to 1933. In the book, she points out the high number of women, both Native and non-Native, who worked for the U.S. Indian Service before it became known as the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Cahill says their mission was to try to assimilate the tribes they worked with.
So the idea that Native cultures were destined to die out, sort of anthropological theory, was that Native people were vanishing. But one way to stop that was to assimilate them into kind of Anglo-middle class culture. It also had the added bonus for the federal government of getting rid of the Native nations as political entities and entities with whom they had treaty obligations.
Cahill will speak about the role of women in the U.S. Indian Service tonight at 7 o'clock in room 106 of the Gallagher Business Building on the University of Montana campus. We'll have a feature interview with Cahill tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
A Habitat for Humanity home in Columbia Falls took great strides towards completion over the past 2 months with the help of young volunteers. A national service group with volunteers aged 18 to 23 came onto the scene 2 months ago, and this month a steady stream of college students are spending spring break in hard hats and tool belts building a home for strangers. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry takes us to the Columbia Falls worksite.
Junior Ashley Hackert is working with two other classmates, cutting metal for the flashing to go along the bottom edge of the townhome.
I've gone to Chicago my past two spring breaks to work on two different builds, and then this year we decided to come to Montana instead, so, yeah.
Hackert is part of a group of college students from the University of Wisconsin, Stout, spending their spring break working for Habitat for Humanity in Columbia Falls. Sophomore Jade Judas says before this, she had never been west of Wisconsin and never built anything.
Definitely going to stick with it. It's a lot of fun. It's it really gets to help you not just like know other people, but I've definitely learned from this too. So,
Judas is majoring in hospitality. This type of work falls way outside her normal frame of study. Senior Jimmy Soderberg is a construction management major at Wisconsin.
I like this kind of work. I mean, it may sound crazy, but it is kind of vacation for me, too. So I like getting out and working with my hands, doing all sorts of construction. So, I mean, I there's something to say for going down to the beach or PCV or something, but I just as much rather be here. So,
Soderberg says his post-graduation goal is to be a site superintendent, coordinating day-to-day operations on a construction site.
I've been involved in Habitat for a couple of years. It's nice that it's a resume boost, but it's also nice to get out here. I mean, it's fun to do trips. We did a trip. We don't come out here, and then we did one down to Chicago last year. So they're fun. They're cheap trips, so what better way to spend a spring break than helping somebody out? So,
this group from Wisconsin is here until the end of the week. Habitat hosted another group of spring breakers last week and will host one more next week. Habitat's usual volunteer days are Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. Construction site supervisor Steve Tartolino says the extra hands are helping push the completion date up.
I think it's an incredible thing that young students nowadays would give up a spring break vacation and come out and work to, well, for all practical purposes, to help strangers.
Tartolino says another group of young volunteers have also been a huge help with this project. 9 weeks ago, a group of eight volunteers came as part of AmeriCorps National Civilian Community Corps. 18-year-old Tessa Kremer joined the Corps after graduating high school in Massachusetts.
Yeah, when we got here, it was actually foundation, and we built this entire house pretty much.
Now, the townhouse has windows installed, volunteers are finishing out the roof, and nailing the blue styrofoam insulation into place. Kremer says she, like many other Habitat volunteers, didn't have any construction experience before arriving, and has increased her vocabulary, among other skills.
Stringers, which is the things you put under the stairs when you build them. You got your 8-penny nails, your 12-penny nails, ring shank nails. I didn't know any types of wood before. Got your 1x4, your 2x4s, and your 1x6s and 2x6s, and they don't actually mean 1x6, it's really 3/4 by 5.5. Interesting.
Kremer is 5 months into the 10-month program. Team leader Morgan Becker says they work projects that focus on disaster services, economic opportunity, education, environmental stewardship, healthy futures, and services for veterans and military families. The Corps is done in Columbia Falls this week. Becker says seeing the new groups come in remind her of where she was when she first got to the worksite.
But getting to see these guys come and work and be unfamiliar with the project or, you know, be amazed at how much is done has, like, really been cool because we've been able to recognize, you know, their, like, some of their skills or whatever in ourselves and, like, see how much we've grown, you know, and be able to say, like, yeah, we built all this. Like, we put in those windows and, like, we sheeted this roof, and it's really, really rewarding.
This neighborhood is filling up. The house under construction sits at the end of a one-way street. When this townhome is finished, it will belong to 2 more families. The whole block has been a Habitat for Humanity project for the past few years. 16 families will own their first homes when it's completed. Habitat has 6 down, 2 more townhouses to go. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
As we reported yesterday, the University of Montana has reached an agreement with the Federal Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, assuring that UM will provide better access for disabled students to campus technology. Amy Capolupo is director of UM Disability Services for Students. In this feature interview, she talks with news director Sally Mock about the agreement, which grew out of complaints from several disabled students about the lack of access.
And some of the key members in that group were students who were involved with the Montana chapter of the National Federation of the Blind. And the National Federation of the Blind is one of the strongest advocacy groups for students with disabilities, actually people with disabilities in the country. And so those students, in combination with what they were experiencing and what was happening nationally, decided to go ahead and file this complaint.
And what was the gist of their complaint?
So there are several things in the complaint itself. One had to do with inaccessible forms in something called the Learning Management System, Moodle. And so what Moodle is it's the online learning environment, essentially. And so what was happening in these features, they're called forum features, and they're essentially like a chat feature would be. So if you and I were in a conversation, Sally, we'd have a topic we had to answer, and I would respond, then you would respond, and then let's say a third member responded, third member in our class. If I'm a blind student or a student with a print disability, the screen reading technology that I'm using to access my classes didn't at that time read that thread in a consistent manner. So I wouldn't have the advantage of viewing the full conversation in the order in which it happened, making my response to that class pretty difficult.
And this was just one of several instances with access to technology, right?
Yeah, right? That's one example of the issues in the complaint.
Since that complaint was filed, though, the university has responded before this agreement, right,
yes,
to try to fix,
yes,
these things.
Yes. In fact, that issue in Moodle, the woman's name is Marlene Zentz. She's an instructional designer for Moodle, and she's actually taken on her entire job now is Moodle accessibility. She's a specialist now basically on campus to do this, and she's actually presenting right now at a national conference as well on these very issues, and she's working on something called Moodle 2 and improving the accessibility. The forum feature has been changed, so that's good news, and not only for us, the University of Montana, but for anyone who uses this particular platform. So it's fixed on all campuses.
And it's not just Moodle, though, right?
No, not just Moodle. No, that's
right.
Just one
example.
Another
example.
So another example would be captioning. Okay, so if a professor was showing a video in class before, you know, well, actually, it still happens. We caption that material. But let's say KUFM, Sally, wanted to put up a video and, you know, it's going to be forward-facing on your website and you want it captioned. because you're affiliated with the university, you can send it to this new office that has been created as a result of this complaint, and they'll caption it for you. And then you can put it up there. You're good to go. There's no additional charge to your campus department. Prior to this, what would happen is we would tell faculty, like disability services, or we would say, look, you're responsible for captioning, but resources weren't really available to do it. But since this office has been formed and the office is accessible technology services, now faculty members can go to this office and have those materials captioned. My office, Disability Services, is still responsible for doing that for students who may be in their class who are deaf or hard of hearing. But overall, campus has the obligation to be accessible for all campus patients.
And this office is new.
This office is brand new. Yeah.
How's the university paying for all this?
That's a good question.
An additional expense.
Right.
Yeah.
So at this point, resources have been shifted. I mean, this is – I feel like there's a lot of disability type organizations on campus, and I'll just name a couple. Rural Institute, there's a new neural injury center, Right Care Clinic, New Directions, my office, Disability Services for Students, and then IT Central. So there's always going to be a push for access on this campus just because there's so many of us focused on this. And when you're talking about general fund dollars, some of those departments I mentioned are, some are not, but the pressure is there. And so to fund this, resources were shifted. And Central IT was the one who stepped up. Matt Riley, actually the new CIO, said, yeah, you know, we're going to take this on. This role should lie with us. This is a technology issue, and we're going to take it on. So they shifted resources within their department to do the same thing in UM Online. They did that as well.
And obviously, Amy, this is an effort that doesn't just affect disabled students.
No.
It affects everybody on campus because we all interact with students who are disabled. And so there will be some training for faculty and staff to be able to adhere to this agreement, correct?
Yes. And I think that that's probably the biggest thing that we're going to have that's still left to do is the faculty training. I mean, that's going to be the biggest component of this. I mean, obviously making sure these resources continue, but the bigger thing is getting this message out about the training, about what resources exist on campus, about where faculty members can go to get these resources. And then also when students encounter a barrier, you know, it's not that they shouldn't – I mean, barriers shouldn't exist, right? We don't want them to exist, but they do. They'll come up in the world as technologies emerge. This office, the new Accessible Technology Services office, should be looking at technologies before they're released to students. But when students have those issues, students need to be informed on what those resources are for them to get these addressed as well. It could be a simple training issue for the student.
And the good news about much of this is that technology can easily provide the kind of services that these students need, right?
Right. And in fact, this is a new development. Like one of the things that was in this original complaint was iClickers. And iClickers are used in class to sort of either take attendance or to answer quizzes in class. And when this complaint was filed, they weren't accessible. Since then, the company's made them accessible. And so that got taken care of just by the fact that the technology's changed and emerged. Another example that we have on here is something called ConvertDoc. And what ConvertDoc does is if you were to take an image, an image-based PDF, let's say, or just going to scan something in your copy machine and, you know, upload it. You can send this document to convertdoc@umontana.edu, and it comes back in a text-based format. That technology didn't exist several years ago. So you can have access in that regard fairly immediately now. It might not be tagged or, you know, perfect, but it's accessible.
Given how much UM is doing on this, I'm guessing that it's doing more than most colleges at this point. Will it be a model, do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, I have a bias there, right, as someone who works here and the Disability Services Director on campus. But I do think so. I think it will be held up. And I think other universities are going to pay attention and look at our agreement and say, this is what we've got to go after. This is the places where we're not compliant at all. I would say that a lot of universities, certainly even in the state of Montana, don't have specific offices who are doing their captioning right now, don't have specific offices who are even looking at this. They may have people, but now we have a more of a central office, and that's a huge thing to come out of this complaint.
Well, I've been speaking with Amy Capolupo, who's director of UM's Disability Services for Students, talking about a new agreement that the University of Montana has reached with the Office of Civil Rights to make campus technology accessible to every student. Amy, thank you.
Yep, thank you very much, Sally. I appreciate your time.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for the West Glacier region. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 12 to 19 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the 30s. For central Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 p.m. tomorrow for the northern Rocky Mountain Front, eastern Glacier, Hill, Cascade, Shodo, Blaine, Judith Basin, Fergus, and Marr counties. Tonight, expect areas of blowing snow, with snow likely, and lows in the teens. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy, with areas of blowing snow and a chance of snow and highs 20 to 25 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with a slight chance of snow and lows 5 to 15 degrees, with wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour in the evening. Tomorrow, expect increasing clouds with a chance of snow and highs 25 to 30 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Rebecca Bendick.
Floods and avalanches are on Montanans' minds right now. That means it's an appropriate time to take a step back and think about natural hazards more generally. We're accustomed to thinking of these disasters as acts of God or bad luck or otherwise entirely outside of our control. However, if we look carefully at disasters worldwide, we see an important result. Natural disasters are more often, though not always, human disasters, because the largest influences on the outcome are social and ethical considerations. Let me give you an example. The Loma Prieta earthquake in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1989 and the 2010 Haiti earthquake were almost identical. They were the same type of earthquake, the same size, with the same amount of shaking. Both occurred in densely populated areas of the world. Yet, 62 people died in California, and something like 316,000 people died in Haiti. The difference was not on the natural side, but on the human side. Everyone in California knows about earthquakes and acts to reduce their impact. Children do earthquake drills, builders must design and build houses, schools, and sports arenas to withstand shaking, and emergency response teams practice for large earthquake response regularly. Almost no one in Haiti knows about earthquakes. No building standards are enforced, there was no emergency response plan, and individuals were completely unprepared. So the difference, more than 300,000 fatalities, came from the human side of the equation. This is a clear example of utilitarian ethics. An investment in preparedness and education spares great later costs and literally saves lives, sometimes lots and lots of them. Furthermore, communities of any size, from neighborhoods to nations, can share the costs of preparedness and consequently share the benefits, protecting those among us who are at greatest risk or least able to protect themselves. These ethical imperatives should inspire us to do a better job of planning for and mitigating natural disasters within our own communities. So how do we do this? First, we should take stock of what risks apply to our own area. The most important are flood, drought, extreme weather, wildfire, avalanche, landslide, volcano, and earthquake, in different amounts for different parts of Montana. For all of these, it is impossible to say exactly what will happen, exactly when, and we will probably never be able to do that. But for most of them, we do have enough data and scientific knowledge to know when and where risks are relatively high or relatively low. We also have the capacity to improve our preparedness for the times and places with the highest risk. How do we do this? First of all, every Montanan should take a bit of time to think about which risks apply to their own community and family. Then, there are three specific things that we all can do to reduce the impact of those risks. First, support large-scale efforts to improve both the science of and planning for major events. Second, work within our smaller communities to create local disaster response plans. And third, make an emergency kit and emergency plan for your own family. For the biggest disasters, only large-scale preparedness and response really works. So we should demand of our government institutions that they take the necessary steps to protect us. Protecting citizens is the fundamental purpose of government. Many earthquake survivors I've met worldwide are more angry than sad about their experience. They feel that their government institutions failed to meet that basic purpose. In order to satisfy their responsibilities, federal, state, and local government entities in the Western United States need to cooperate to improve the science of hazard assessment and the practices of disaster mitigation and response. For smaller disasters, local response is the most important. As we saw with the Mount Jumbo avalanche, quick assistance of neighbors by neighbors can make a huge difference. This works even better if there are already community organizations and emergency plans in place, something like a pre-designated local meeting place, sometimes with stage A like clean water and tools, can speed response organization and make it much easier for separated family members to find one another. Finally, at the smallest scale, an emergency kit has everything you need to survive for 3 days without help: water, food, warm clothes, and first aid materials. An emergency plan is a family plan for exactly what to do in a disaster. In this case, families can mean any group of people who care for one another, and utilitarian ethics demand that we include elderly, disabled, or isolated neighbors and friends. There are a few disasters that we can't possibly anticipate or prepare for, but in the majority of cases, just a few little things done in advance can make all the difference.
Rebecca Bendick is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.